For those of you who are new at Holden, welcome to a small group discussion here. And those of you who have been here know that we're trying to pursue a little series on a number of tragic dramas. We've taken a look at Oedipus's, at Sophocles' Oedipus the King, and then we spent some time on King Lear to see two different treatments, Greek and Elizabethan, Shakespearean treatments of tragedy. And we were going to take a look at kind of a modern, we could call it naturalistic tragedy by Ibsen, namely Ghosts. And I'm glad we didn't do that for two counts. Number one, I think it was rather good that we spent 2 days on King Lear. And secondly, a lady told me that her little daughter was all set to come to hear the lecture on ghosts because she wanted to hear some interesting ghost stories. And I'm glad she wasn't here because it's more ghastly than a good ghost story. Ibsen's story is the kind of a grim story about a young man who comes back from Paris because he is ill. And his mother is trying to cover up the last shades of the last ghosts of her husband's rather seedy career, namely his drunkenness, which had been pretty well covered up in town. And so she erects I think it's an orphanage, a children's home, in her husband's honor. And then within a very quick time, several dreadful things come out in the wash. One is that the young man has a disease which he's inherited from his father. Ibsen was under the conception that this venereal disease could be inherited. He was wrong in that count, but I don't think it invalidates the power of the play. That comes out. And then it also comes out that the young girl to whom the boy is kind of attracted turns out to be the illegitimate daughter of this man. So at the end of the story, rather than that the mother is able to cover up the ghosts of the past, they are exposed. And not only that, but she who wanted finally to be free and experience the joy of life, the joie de vivre, is chained to this boy of hers who has had a first really serious attack of this disease, and she knows she's going to have to care for him forever. In other words, a living reminder of the very thing that she thought she would be free of. Now, what's interesting is that Ibsen is still attempting to create a tragedy, but he lacks some of the major resources that the Greeks and the Elizabethans simply took for granted and had, namely an orderly world. A cosmic order which relates to a personal order, an order of cosmic justice and personal justice. And so Ibsen attempts to do something like create an orderly world by taking the one thing which we all consider to have some kind of order, namely physical disease and that, or reproduction. By the time we get to the 20th century, and now I want to hop to the play for today, we are in a world where critics lament the fact that we can no longer write really great tragedies. And instead we have all sorts of attempts at literature, particularly drama that catches a slice of life, or perhaps that mixes comedy and tragedy, or that raises profound questions in strange, odd ways. And Beckett's Waiting for Godot, I think, falls in this last category. It's sometimes been called the theater of the absurd, or a classic example of that. And it is such a strange play that when one first sees it, and comes from the experience of the kind of plays perhaps that we studied in college some years ago, or the plays that we see in an average high school stage, we may wonder, what is this all about? And how could this possibly be taken seriously? Well, before I briefly summarize the play, I'd like to share with you a little experience I had on a hiking trail just the other day. I took two sons of friends of ours up to Heart Lake to go fishing. And we were trudging along, and we had walked about, 45 minutes, and one of the boys said, "Are we nearly there?" And I said, "Well, not quite. In fact, we still have quite a ways to go. But we'll stop after we've walked an hour." And then we took a break there. Then we got going again, and we pretty soon exhausted all the normal topics of conversation. And it really started getting long, and one of the boys said, "Well, couldn't I have a drink?" So we stopped, and we had a drink. That was after the second hour. And then one of the boys said, "Let's play Take a Trip." And I said, "Let's play what?" So they introduced me to a little game that they play, to kill time, to while away the time. And it goes like this. Do any of you know this game? I know. Do you?
Taking something with you.
Yes. The first person starts out by saying, "I'm going to take a trip to Hawaii, and I'm taking a sleeping bag." And then the next person repeats those very words, and the object is, as you go around in a group of three or four persons, that each person adds an object and remembers all the preceding objects and where you're going. Now, for the first 5, 6, 7 objects, it's pretty good if you're paying attention. But, you know, after a while, we were saying, "Help me out," or give me a hint. And it becomes a team effort to remember. Well, we did it once, and then we fell off, and then we did it again. And we got to about object number 6, and the younger boy said, "Do we have to go on with this?" And then there was long silence, you know, this and that. Well, we finally made it. It was great. That experience of experiencing time all of a sudden, time on your hands, and doing something with words to while away the time, is, I think, kind of a modest little illustration of something of that, of what's going on in Waiting for Godot. Let me briefly summarize the story, and then I want to raise again the question of why is this such a popular play? And then after that, maybe what's it all about? How many of you have read the play? Okay, have any of you seen it on stage or TV? Okay. Help me out if I leave details out or things that are significant. The play consists of two acts. It's a bare stage except for, I think, a virtually dead tree, often put in kind of an abstract fashion. And the stage vanishes in the background in a darkness. You can't see into the distance. It's just black depth. And very often just a pool of light on the stage so that the darkness goes in every direction, including to the audience. There are two tramps, Vladimir and Estragon, Didi and Gogo, as they affectionately call each other, who are waiting, whiling away the time in the twilight on a rather nondescript, tangay-like road somewhere in the middle of no place. And they're waiting for a person by the name of Godot, who said that he would be with them. He had said that yesterday, that he would be with them today. And so they're waiting for him, but he hasn't come. These are tramps who seem to be uprooted from society. They don't seem to have any connections with anything. They vaguely remember better times, and on occasion when they're trying to make conversation, They try to recall them, but do it only dimly. Though I remember one time Estragon recalls, I believe it was Estragon, that Vladimir had rescued him from drowning, and they try to recall some of the details. They can't remember quite where it was, somewhere in France. And then I believe Estragon ends up by berating his friend for having saved him. We would have been better off maybe if I would have drowned. Gives you some of the flavor, both grim, kind of dark, perhaps black humor, and also a certain brooding despair and pessimism. Well, they have absolutely nothing to do, and so they distract themselves with various little things, like pulling off their boots, and that takes a long time, or voiding, or munching on, looking for a carrot, and then they remember they don't have a carrot, it's only a turnip, and he finally finds it somewhere in his grimy pocket, and it turns out to be a carrot after all. Munch on that, and that's the last object they have. Absolutely nothing happens, and they're waiting. One exception. Two other characters eventually come on stage, and it's a gruesome sight. One, the first that comes in, is a weird-looking character with baggy pants and some white hair falling out from under his hat, and he's got a huge rope around his neck. He's carrying a bag and carrying something else, and he keeps coming across, and he's nearly off the other side of the stage when that long rope finally shows us his master, a sort of over-the-hill, aristocratic-type person who, in a way, is like a circus man with an incredible long whip. And that's Pazzo, and the fellow who he has carrying his goods is Lucky. So it's a classic master-slave situation. And some things happen there, conversation, Lucky doesn't say anything except he whimpers a little bit, and at one point when Dee Dee and Gogo are concerned about the poor fellow, and Gogo goes over to try to help him out, Lucky suddenly viciously kicks his leg, as if all the frustration of life comes out, and poor Gogo is hurt and draws back. They finally ask him if he can do anything, and he says, well, he can, and he can do this, that, or the other thing, and I think they let him do a dance. And he does a dance which is called the net. It had other names before. And finally, he gives a speech, and that is, he can think. And Pazzo has taught him everything he knows. It's sort of a cram course in Western Civ, all garbled, all crazy, and just coming out mechanically, zzz, like this. Finally stops, they leave the stage. Pazzo says he's going off to a certain fair to sell him. Yet you sense that Pazzo can't get along without him, just like Dee Dee and Gogo can't get along without each other. And then again, they've got time on their hands, and suddenly there's a little boy's voice. He comes on stage, and the little boy comes from Godot. And Mr. Godot has sent him to say that he will not be here this evening, but he's coming for certain tomorrow. They question the boy a little bit about how life is for him, and the boy herds the goats, we're told, and Mr. Godot is fairly good to him. And it turns out there's a brother, and he herds the sheep. And Mr. Godot beats him. And finally the boy leaves. And there they are, and they decide, what should they do? Well, let's go. And they say, let's go. And then the last stage direction is that they stay right there. They don't move. That's the end of the play. End of Act 1. Act 2 is virtually the same thing. There are a few little changes. The tree has some leaves on it. After a while, Pazzo and Lucky come in. Again, they look completely bedraggled, and Pazzo is now blind, and Lucky is dumb. And their presence there is a little shorter, and then they finally leave the stage, and Vladimir, who does a little bit more talking, he seems to be more like the mind in turn. He emphasizes that aspect of man, perhaps, and Gogol more the feeling self, the body. He's always concerned about his pains and his aches. And at any rate, they exchange some words and finally end up talking about committing suicide. That's the way out. And they look at the tree, and they decide that they don't have enough of a rope for it. And then they decide to use their belt, but the belt isn't long enough. And then they're worried, if one of them goes, how is the other one going to be able to commit suicide, because only one can get to the tree with the help of the other. And so that makes it pretty grim as far as doing that. And they said, well, let's try our belt anyway. He takes his belt off, his pants fall down, and they pull at the belt, which is a rope, and it just falls apart. So there they are. They can't even commit suicide. And they exchange a few more words and finally say, well, let's go. And once again, they stand there doing nothing. That's about, in brief, a summary of the story. I'd like to share my own experience of seeing it for the first time. I was with a friend back in 1958, I believe, in New York. And we knew nothing about Beckett. We knew nothing about theater, the absurd, really. We were just lucky enough to be in New York together, and we both had other jobs. We weren't there primarily to study theater at all. And once a week, we tried to go down and see a play of some sort. And we had heard that this play is here, and Bert Lehr, famous comedian, is doing the part of Estragon. So we thought, let's go see it. Everyone else is going. Well, we sat there, looked at each other in the dimness, and after the first act, we were ready to walk out. And the only reason we stayed was we had each paid, I think, $6 for the seats. I mean, that was a lot of money for us in those days. And we said, we're going to get our money's worth, even though we hated every moment of it, as it were. We were extremely puzzled, in a way put off. We had a hard time following the dialogue, paying attention. It wasn't until some time later, when I had a chance to reread the play and do some thinking about it, that some things began to gel. I'd like to pause here and see if any of you who've seen the play had similar reactions to it in first experience. Any comments on just the play at that level? Sort of gut level, first impressions. Without coming from a literature classroom where you've had introduction to theater and then introduction to theater of the absurd, so you appreciate what this style is a story that Martin Esslin tells in a little book called The Theater of the Absurd. In fact, he's a person who coined that title. And I don't think Beckett particularly would like to say he is writing for Theater of the Absurd. That's something that someone else has put on for him. But Martin Esslin has written a very fine book, at least it was helpful for me, introductory book on Theater of the Absurd. Tells of a performance of the play that the San Francisco Actors Workshop did back in 1957. And they did it for the prisoners at San Quentin. The prisoners there had not seen a play for some 44 years, since 1913, when Sarah Bernhardt appeared. She used to do some Ibsen plays and so on. I don't know, have any of you ever seen her? Heard of her, yeah. I guess she must have been a great actress. Well, nobody's old enough to. 1913, oh, some people have been around that long and longer.
At any rate, the amazing thing is the play communicated instantly. And the prisoners' reactions were, that's what our life is like. You know, and some said, that man must have been in prison. Because it expresses and conveys the feeling of what it's like to have time on your hands and not to get away, and to be locked in with somebody else, whom sometimes you could just hate and kill, and yet you can't get along without that cellmate of yours, that table mate of yours. It's sort of like the marriage of convenience, where you're in it, and you hate it, and yet you can't get out of it, and in a way you don't want to get out of it. And here they are saying that's how we felt. Well, by all the conventional standards of theater, I don't think we would normally call the play anything like a good play. There's no serious plot, something happening, a major conflict building up to some kind of a resolution. The characters are nondescript. They're sort of at the bottom of the ladder. Hobos, tramps. The conversation, now that's rather interesting. Once one listens to it carefully, it's lively. There is some comedy in it. They are, in fact, quite alive with their language, even though they have to make an effort to talk. But just that effort itself has a verve to it. And at times when they don't know what to say to each other anymore, the terror of these gaps in conversation comes through powerfully. So, by those standards, it's not the play fails. But by some other standards, the play communicates. It communicates at a feeling level. And let me suggest maybe one or two things which I think give the play its sustaining popularity at several levels. For one thing, it catches the feeling, the experience of waiting without any real hope for something to deliver one from that waiting. Might say it's Advent without Christmas. Waiting around for something to happen, which, as Rich Kemmerer said the other night in his last devotion, there's some of us here who are just waiting for something to happen, who don't have something that we want to do ourselves. Waiting for something to happen, and eventually something does happen. This play conveys the experience of waiting for something to happen and nothing happens. Or waiting in a different sense, waiting for something which is going to be the answer to all our waiting, and letting that perhaps paralyze us from doing anything else in the meantime. And this agonizing feeling of lack of fulfillment. That's one kind of experience with which the play, I think, communicates. There's something else about the play that at another level brings chuckles. It's the humor of the play. There are these efforts to get one another to talk. And I think we've experienced that ourselves. You know, we say to someone else, well, say something, don't just sit there. And then the person says something. And sometimes we mimic each other in saying something. And then we may comment about the fact, oh, we're carrying on a good conversation. Isn't that great? How interesting this is. And there's a certain sarcasm about it. But even that kind of play whiles away the time for the time being. Let's tell jokes. Some of the humor involves some interesting references to biblical themes. There are references to the thief on the cross. There are references to Christ. In the French version, when Lucky, when Pazzo says he's going to take Lucky off to sell him,
He's taking him to, my French is not too good, but it's Saint Savior's Fair. Holy Savior's Fair. Now that's removed in the English translation. There is humor at another level. The humor that things keep getting lost. Pazzo, who comes in, kind of a Mr. Elegance and Nobility over the hill, sits on a chair. It's a little folding chair, and he pulls out his atomizer, and there's his watch and his meerschaum pipe. And gradually he begins losing these objects. And it's kind of funny at first, but it's also strange and weird how he loses objects. Or the men can't get, one of them can't get his trouser off, and there's a lot of pulling and tugging, and finally the trouser gets off. The boot gets off. Or they have difficulty voiding. And there's a kind of grim, black, cosmic humor when one of them wants to laugh, and then he grabs his groin because he can't laugh. He has a pain. And, you know, maybe we've experienced this. If we've had operations and someone comes to a hospital room and tells us a joke, and it's so funny, we laugh, and all of a sudden we remember we're in the hospital, and we can't laugh.
Maybe that's where I pick up on the idea of things being present or absent. It's in a sense the idea that we don't really have things to the extent they're present. It's rather that we have things to the extent that we know they're absent. That is, we don't have things as such. They're almost transparent as such. But that in the moment in which we no longer have it, then we know it's not there. In other words, there's always a kind of catching up in a certain sense, a kind of coming in behind yourself, that the play seems to do quite a lot. That is, that we learn about things through lacking them, not through having them.
Great.
Think that works?
I like that. I like that. Beckett raises our level of awareness by how they become aware too late of things that they're missing in this case. Another aspect of the play that I think is intriguing for maybe particularly for people who come from a religious tradition and a Christian tradition is the many explicit religious references. Simon Weil, a Jewish lady who died very early in life, almost starving herself to death at the age of 34, in 1943, during the war, was a Jewish who became a convert, in a sense, to Roman Catholicism, though she never took the final step, that is to say, she never was baptized. And one of the books that she wrote was entitled Waiting for God. And amongst other things she indicates here, she wanted to be on that borderline between Roman Catholicism, between Judaism and Roman Catholicism, experiencing the sense of waiting. Perhaps Beckett deliberately picks up his Waiting for Godot from the title of Simon Weil, with a sense of the not yet of that which everyone in a conventionally Christian world just assumes is there, that God is available for meaning and for helping us to be aware of who we are and what we have as a present possession. So Simon Weil's title, Waiting for Godot, is, I think, one of the echoes in the play. There's a story of the thief on the cross to which the men allude, and what they comment about is the fact that the gospel writers don't seem to agree about the stories at all. In fact, only one of them tells about the thief that was saved. And then Gogo comments in turn to Didi, well, it's a pretty good percentage. One saved, one lost. You've got about expect that as far as the percentages go. There's a reference to the tree, perhaps a reference to the tree of the cross. There are some references to prayer. There may be some references to falling down, to dying, to rising up again. Lucky, it's been suggested, is almost a kind of a Christ figure. In other words, there are fragments of the Christian story scattered around like bits and pieces floating through the air. That those bits and pieces are there?
Yeah.
Well, Beckett is a very brilliant person, and he knows just what he's doing, and he surely puts the bits and pieces in. Some interpretations want to read it as a subtly recovery of basic Christian meaning amidst all the fragments of life. I have a hard time with that interpretation. At the feeling level, that surely is not what the play communicates, and everything else that Beckett's done seems to militate against that. But some interesting people have suggested that as a thesis, and at least it's worth looking at. Perhaps those are three of the features of the play which make it attractive. The gut-level experience of waiting, the kind of humor that scintillates through the play, and some of these religious illusions that attract us, particularly the notion of waiting for Godot. Is that not what Christian life is like? Waiting for God, waiting for heaven. If it is, perhaps then Beckett is critiquing very sharply a kind of empty waiting. When an American playwright, Alan Schneider, first produced the play on Broadway, he wrote Beckett, or I think even telephoned, and asked him what Godot means. And let's see if I can find the quote. I have it written down here in one of my notes. Yeah, the short and long of the quotation is as follows, that Beckett says, if I would have known what Godot stands for, I would have made it clear in the play. So he has always rigorously drawn back from making any statements about who Godot is or what the play means. He just wants the play to be. So Beckett withdraws from all attempts to give a specific interpretation of the play. What I'd like to do before we go into maybe a slightly different approach to the play, I'd like to suggest a couple of things that it says to me and how we might relate it to the theme of tragedy. I'd like to spend a few moments to let you hear, those of you who've never heard or seen the play or read it, to hear some dialogue. I've taken a section from scene 2 where Didi and Gogo are conversing with each other, and they have just gotten through the night, and they're doing some reviewing, and we see how the problem of forgetting helps make aware again what it was that they experienced. One of them forgets and the other tries to remember. And then after that, I think we should hear the thinking speech.
Will you look at me?
They embrace each other here.
Another day. Who beats you, tell me? Another day's done with.
Not yet.
For me, it's over and done with, no matter what happens. I heard you singing.
That's right. I remember.
That finished me. I said to myself, he's all alone. He thinks I'm gone forever. And he sings.
One is not master of one's moods. All day I felt in great form. I didn't gap at all in the night. Not once.
You see? You function better when I'm not there.
I missed you, and at the same time I was happy. Isn't that a strange thing?
Happy?
Well, perhaps it's not quite the right word.
And now?
Now? There you are again. There we are again.
Mm.
There I am again.
Mm. You see, you feel worse when I'm with you. I feel better alone, too.
Then why do you always come crawling back?
I don't know.
No, but I do. It's because you don't know how to defend yourself. I wouldn't have let them beat you.
You couldn't have stopped them.
Why not?
There were 10 of them.
No, I mean before they beat you. I would have stopped you from doing whatever it was you were doing.
I wasn't doing anything.
Then why did they beat you?
I don't know.
No, Gogo. The truth is, there are things that escape you that don't escape me. Now, you must feel it yourself.
I tell you, I wasn't doing anything.
Perhaps you weren't, but it's the way of doing it that counts. The way of doing it, if you want to go on with it.
But I wasn't doing anything.
Well, you must be happy, too, deep down, if you only knew it. Happy?
About what?
To be back with me again.
Would you say so?
Say you are, even if it isn't true.
What am I to say?
Say I am happy.
I am happy.
So am I.
So am I.
We are happy.
We are happy. What do we do now that we're happy?
Wait for Godot. Things have changed here since yesterday.
And if he doesn't come?
We'll see about that when the time comes. I was saying, things have changed here since yesterday.
Everything oozes.
The tree.
Never the same pus from one second to the next.
The tree. Look at the tree.
Wasn't it there yesterday?
Of course it was there yesterday. Don't you remember? We nearly hanged ourselves from it. But you would.
Don't you remember? You dreamt it.
Is it possible you've forgotten that already?
That's the way I am. Either I forget immediately, or I never forget.
And Pozzo and Lucky, have you forgotten them too?
Pozzo? Lucky?
He's forgotten everything.
I remember a crazy man kicking the shins off me, and nearly acted like a fool.
That was Lucky.
I remember that. But when was it?
And his keeper, don't you remember him?
He gave me a bone.
That was Pozzo.
And all that was yesterday, you say?
Of course it was yesterday.
Right here where we are now.
Oh, where else do you think? Don't you recognize the place?
Recognize? Recognize? What is there to recognize? All my lousy life I've crawled about in the mud. And you talk to me about scenery? Look at this dung heap. I've never stirred from it.
Calm yourself.
You and your landscapes.
Tell me about the worms. All the same, you tell me that this bears any resemblance to Vaucluse, for example. You can't.
We shift back now to Act One, where Lucky is being shown off for being able to think. And he goes into his automatic think, which is a very, very quick speech. Can you hear clearly in the back? Okay. Well, we'll let it speak for itself.
Given the existence of the report from the public works of Punchin and Whatman of a personal guard.
Quack, 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 quack.
With white beard. Outside time, without extension, who provides divine apathia, divine apathia, divine aphasia, loves us dearly, with some exceptions, for reasons unknown, but time will tell, and suffers, like the divine Miranda, with those who, for reasons unknown, but time will tell, are plunged in torment, plunged in fire, whose fire flames, if that continues, and if that will fire permanent, that is to say, black hell, the heavens of room, still and calm, so calm, what calm, he's never connected, he's never
but not so
fast! And considering what is more, that after the notable labors left unfinished, crammed the baguette, cattered me about performatory Vivian Fuzzy, gargantuan colossal, it is established beyond all doubt, or rather now the back which clings to the labors of men, that after the notable labors unfinished, perpetuate the law, it is
established beyond but not so fast!
Know that as a result of the public works of Punchin and Whatman, it is established beyond all doubt that the good ladies will come up in Belgium. That confidence will lead to their own dangerous commander company. It is established what many deny. That man is what you take to a canard, that man in it, that man in short. That man is rich in spite of the strength of adamantation and deprecation. Who I stand by. Oh, I stand by.
Oh, no, no.
Do you hear that? And because of this, I will tell you what is more. For reasons unknown, in spite of the strife of physical culture, the practice of watching the standards of football running, cycling, swimming, flying, drumming, riding, gliding, connecting, promoting, skating, tennis of all kinds, dying, flying, home, but time will tell.
Thanks, away! How is you?
Put on, grab on. Well, there's no bags at the reservation factory. Means a tune of 1 inch, 4 ounces per head approximately. By a lot more or less than any decimal. But mess around, bigger, stark naked. In the stocking feet, it's cousin Marla. In the worst of the word. For he's unknown no matter what matter. The facts are there. And if Jimmy was small, much more clay than the rightful lady was forced to sign with the pen. It appears was small, much more clay than the light. Of the lady's lost to Steinberg and Peter. And in the plains, in the mountains, by the seas, by the rivers running water from his fire, the air is the same as in the earth. Namely, the air of the earth, in the great cold, the great dark, the air of the earth, and all the stones of the great cold. And after that, in the beginning of their roar, 600 and something, the earth lives a few years of water stones in the great deeps, the great cold on sea, on land, and the air.
Oh.
How it is you? For reasons are only by such end. The facts are there, but time will tell. I need you, alas. Alas. On, in short time. On, of those of stone. Oh, can thou get? I need you, but not so fast. I need you.
Go, fading.
Fading. And so it is amazing once more. For reasons are only by such end. On. The bit of a face is no sugar to power.
Felt at a certain point, that's enough, turn it off, that's exactly how they feel on stage. And they can't, once he starts, they can't stop him. And they have to grab his hat. And then he stops and collapses. That's the only time he ever talks throughout the whole play. And,
he made up for that.
Yeah, it's sort of like the wisdom of all of Western civilization, just in a jumble bag, spewed out, and no longer having any coherence. And it seems that one of the things that the play catches for me is this terror that language doesn't anymore build a bridge between where I am, where an individual is, and the world out there, that it's broken down and are just fragments and bits. By way of a concluding suggestion of a direction for thinking about this play, I'd like to follow the following line of thought. One reason I like to put the play into a series with tragedy is that it is not unrelated to the great central theme of suffering that we see in plays like Oedipus or like King Lear. There is a kind of suffering going on here, and it's the suffering of waiting. It's the suffering of time on one's hands. It's maybe even further, the suffering of just being. There are various ways, I think, which that comes across. One is a great deal of uncertainty surrounds the figures in the play. They don't know where they are. They don't know what day it is. They try to pin that down, time and place, but they're never sure. Very often, you hear them being unsure about objects. They're not sure if a person has a watch or has a time. Objects get lost, and then afterwards we're not sure if they had them. After they part from one another,
They are not sure if they were there the day before. When they see the boy the second time, they ask the boy, and it's the very same boy, at least I think it was, when I saw him on stage, if he was there the day before, and he says, no, he wasn't. And one of the requests that they have when the boy says, do you want me to say anything to Godot, they decide, just tell him you saw us. They are not even sure if they exist, because how do I know if I exist if no one even remembers me, recognizes, sees me? So there's uncertainty about everything. Another feature of the play is a terrible sense of inaction, nothing to do, and all these futile efforts to attempt to do something in the meantime. The meantime is an empty time. And I think at the center of that is the experience of boredom. I think all of us have experienced boredom at times, and I'm not sure what, how significant a notion it is for you. A book by the name of The Structure of Awareness by Thomas Oden gave me a good handle on the notion of boredom. He says every single human being has to deal with certain fundamental realities. Now, this is very abstract, but let me try it out on you for size. Namely, all of us have to deal with the present, the past, and the future. And all of us have to deal somehow with our relation to ourself, to other persons, to our world, and to what's ultimately there and what will ultimately bring our life to an end. Call it God or what will you. And now, because man is the kind of creature he is, who has to make choices and is aware of his choices, he's always choosing between values. And once I've made certain choices and look back on the past, I can readily feel uneasy about the choices I've made. I may feel I made bad choices. And so my relationship, if I'm uneasy about choices, about the past, he summarizes in the one word, guilt. We'll feel guilty about bad choices. We don't feel guilty about the future. What we feel about the future is anxiety if we can't deal with anticipating future choices. And now the word he uses for when we are ill at ease with the present is boredom. When we don't know how to choose in respect to the present, then we experience boredom, that nothing really makes sense in the present. So the notion of meaninglessness in terms of my relation to the very present moment could be captured by the notion of boredom. Now I think we get a sense of that, though they never use, well, yes, they do. They use the word bored. At times they are bored. And then they attempt to do something to cover up their boredom. But it's also very thin. At times there are long silences. And that's the last thing that I like to come to. I think in those long silences and the tone of voice that the actors, in which the actors speak, particularly Estragon, who is more the feeling person, we get the terror of what it is to exist and just to be aware of the fact that I'm existing. And what about this organism, me, that's existing? What do we do now? Say something, anything. These moments of terror, I think, catch us at that moment where the suffering of existence confronts us with the blank terror of being. Does all of this have anything pertinent to say to us as Christians? Is it worth spending time on a play like this?
Well, I just have a question on this boredom. Only those that experience the way he defines guilt of the past, anxiety about the future, are those only those that are bored, or are those preconditions, or what? So that would be the present boredom if you experience guilt feeling about bad choices and anxieties about the future. Is that what he's saying?
No, I don't think he's saying that. He's saying that a person may be hung up, let's say, in the past, with something in the past, and then his major problem would be guilt and dealing with that in some way. For instance, in King Lear, we experience a lot of things, but we sure don't experience boredom. Right? There's an agony, but the agony is the agony of all of the feeling of being trapped by partly what his daughters are doing to him and partly by the sense that he's brought this on himself. He doesn't experience boredom. But in this play, we don't experience guilt. There's nothing like the tragic, there's nothing like a sense of we made some bad mistakes in the past. They do sometimes explore the idea, wouldn't it have been better if we would have separated from one another? But that possibility, they explore and then they toss out. Somehow they can't get along with each other, but they can't get along without each other. But there's no sense of guilt about it. Stefan.
Same response there too. As you said, no sense of guilt. Part of that past feeling could be sometimes a feeling that not only perhaps guilt that wrong choices made, or it'd be just against the sense of the routine and awareness that one is in a routine and in a rut somehow, and perhaps even that routine or that way of life is breaking up. It no longer, one is aware, it's no longer giving meaning to your life. It's changing, or you want to change it. And anxiety that you can't change it, and an even greater terror that any other, you can't, there's nothing to change to. You could replace it with another system of living, another system of belief, another way of going by day to day, yet that, a feeling that even that would not suffice, and so you look with anxiety towards the future that doesn't seem to offer anything different and more meaningful than what you're doing right today. This is your cut.
Okay. Any other comments or observations? Yeah, Marshall?
Well, I've always found it interesting the people that I've been associated with have complained the most about being bored. Just, you know, some people say they're bored all the time, and other people never even occurs to them to be bored. But the ones that I've seen that have said, oh, I'm bored today, it isn't because they don't have something to do most of the time. It's usually because they don't want to do what it is that they have to do. I don't know whether that's a case with other people that you've seen that say that they're bored. It seems to be something that they it's almost that, well, I should do this, but I don't want to, but so instead I'm going to be bored. It seems rather strange to me that I've noticed that about people.
There's a kind of alienation in boredom, you're saying, between the person and the task.
No, task in life in general, it's usually not that there's only one task, but they have their option of several tasks, none of which they want to do. Maybe to relate to the characters in the play, they could break up, but they don't want to. They'd rather stay together bored. Is that accurate? I don't know.
Well, as an observation about life, I think, you know, we probably might well be accurate for some persons. The interesting thing about the play is they don't seem to have a choice. Right? They're trapped by that darkness out there. In a way, it's a very metaphysical play. Very abstract, really.
Well, the people that I've heard talking about being bored seem to be trapped with that also. They don't want to be bored. They just seem to be. And I've, the people that I've noticed this.
In the play, it seems to me these the two main characters are trapped with the notion that to be is to do, or to be is to be with, or to be is to have something come in for you, and to wait is to be bored, like you say, and to be nothing, nothingness is, and that you must fill nothingness with doing, and without doing you are nothing and there is nothing, and the doing nonetheless is still only a game, and it goes, it came from no place and it goes no place, and while you're in the midst of it, it fills the time that is nothing. And I think the play is great. I just think it's one of the more marvelous things I've seen from it. And really, because I think for myself, you know, hell, I'm a good game player, you know, and it's fun to manufacture things to do, okay? So I can identify with these guys, you know, out there, you know, have fun tying your shoes, you know, spend a half hour trying to figure out how to do that, you know, or how to put on a boot or take it off, do something like that. But really, and I guess that's where I have, I'm having a little, I wasn't here for the other two lectures, because I can't recall all of the identifying features of tragedy. But I'm having trouble seeing it as a tragedy.
I don't see it as a tragedy either.
Okay, right. Because when you made comment about the three plays in sequence and you like to put it in that context, I can see how that can be done. But it is not my perception that this is in any way a classic example of tragedy.
No.
It's a lie.
Let's see. Somebody made an observation about the... Gretchen, you had a comment too.
I did,
yeah.
Yeah. That one of the things I think about the theater, the absurd, is... And it relates to what you were saying about they have all these things to do, and why shouldn't they do them, not before, is that it points out the absurdity of what we consider our purpose. That we think that we're motivated by serious purpose, and we find that really it's all reduced to ornamentation. I mean, most of what we think is our purpose is probably ways of filling up time or ways of feeling good about what, you know, things we're doing. We say it's a purpose, but in fact we probably do something because it makes us feel important, or it makes, we really just like to do it, and we create a purpose to go along with liking to do it. And I think one of the things is that we don't like to do a lot of things, that, and we have the purpose illusion stripped away from them, the mind is really absurd.
I think the play is offensive. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is an offense.
Yeah.
And I guess the only reason that it becomes kind of a delightful offense is it allows you to laugh at yourself.